The worked every man according to his deserts, his family, and he's going to stay flipping on his life. Nobody can claim innocence in any of these things. If you're without sin, go ahead and cast the first stone. And the point is, the punishment will come, but by whose hand? Who was supposed to execute it? I wasn't called upon to do that. And the same thing here. You notice another thing here, the pure of ethics holds others strictly to these commandments, but are very clever in devising loopholes for ourselves. As far as that goes, as long as we know it, just say, you know. So what? Sure. Then you raise it, you're on the side. Because again, here is, there's one chapter in the and the Ammonites refused to take up arms anymore. It refuses this one. Eight times it says, any kind of war is murder. All war is murder. All life says, he's innocent to his party. He all participates in the various degrees. Because if you continue to react, you're responsible too. You're contributory. You're accessory to the crime. If somebody gets murdered, you might not care if you might have engineered the thing. In the same way, where do you draw the line? If you're going to say, anyone who's been responsible for taking life at any time or any place, then we're all wiped out as far as that goes. See, this is to be left up to higher courts as far as that goes. And this is why we do this. But as I say, if all the participants in war murder it, then we can do temple work for anyone who's engaged in being active in the field. But we're really not speaking very clearly at all. We're going to mention probabilism in a minute. Again, you notice, the confirmed liar shall be cast out. Well, again, we say, what about this policy? Number of speech by Clement Stone, the eighth insurance man of this land, he said he could see nothing wrong in government officials lying under oath, because that's what they're trained to do, he said. At Harvard, they give a course now called Tactical Misrepresentation in Business, Salesmanship, but they call it that, Tactical Misrepresentation. We had a man here who used to go giving a talk of business strategy. Well, strategy is defined in the dictionary as deception practiced on an enemy. That's what strategy is. The only definition it gives is deception practiced on an enemy. Well, the public is offering you resistance, it has to be overcome. You challenge the enemy, you do that by strategy. Sales strategy, some of the sales strategies in the time of deception, is how to put people into buying deception. Well, the concerned liar is going to be cast out. Again, the question is by whom, for what? It must be a very picturesque liar to be cast out. The funny thing is, that the picturesque liar is rather a harmless thing because everybody says things that are very wrong. Of course, it's the rhetoric, the subtle lie, who is the danger thing, as Macbeth found out, you know, when he says, the fiend that lies like thief, that our friends who win us to our arm, the start with, tell us truth, win us with honest fighters, to be present, to keep us comfortable. There are ways of lying, and the fiend knows how to lie like thief. Well, then here's a positive command, love thy life with all thy heart. That distinctly says you could make an effort. Another thing to not being able to control yourself is love thy wife with all thy heart and speak to her. And thou shalt love thy wife with all thy heart and thou shalt speak to her and none else. So this raises a very interesting question. What about the celibacy and the love of God? The reason St. Augustine can never get married is because of his slogan and highway or hell, I cleave to God. The idea was if he pleased to God, it had to be with the total love, therefore he can't share with anybody else. Therefore, he couldn't get married. And his mother, Santa Monica, wouldn't let him get married. He'd have all the girls he wanted. But as he writes it, the thing is, it is not sex that detracts one's mind from God, but domestic concerns and preoccupation. Because if you have a lot of swallowing kids and snowy cabbage cooking and watch out in the line and so forth, very easy because you can't think of God in those circumstances. And that's why he was married, because his domestic life, he said, was distracting from meditation on God, from constantly putting his mind on God. So as far as he wanted to enjoy sex, then he could do that all he wanted, because that's just a short thing. Then he could get back to meditating on God, and he did that really well over very different thing, you know, this year. So when they tell us, I know the statement came last week, the Pope made a statement that very strong defending celibacy. It's a life vow of our nation, like the idea that if you please to God, and it goes to both males and females, then you cannot please to another, you cannot have husband and wife. You know there's something wrong with that. That is what the very careful of what the Muslims call shirk, the doctrine of shirk, which is that believing in anything can exist besides God, which is an outrage. Well, I'm sorry, that's the way it is. You don't go into these spirits. See, the idea of God, by existence, on that, merely to exist, only God has the right to exist. And for anything else to exist, it's sheer presumption, it's outrageous. It's challenging the uniqueness and oneness of God. It's outrageous for an imperfect creature to select his last for a quick second. It's horrible. That's the crime of spirit, or sharing, or dividing. You get pluralism, you get a multiple universe, you get conflicting, well, varied interests and so forth, and there's more than one individual in the universe, and this is an awful, awful thing. But it's too late to start worrying about that now, because that's the way it is, as far as register. We're not philosophical religion, because you don't argue. We are not a speculative religion. We accept certain given qualities, but they're not up to the specific. When you say nothing we shouldn't exist is wrong, all right, so it may be wrong, but here we are. There should be no evil, there should be no such a thing as evil, all right, so that's right, if I'm wrong. But you have to accept these things, and you used to say that you should have thought of that before you left home. You like to change now, as far as that goes. But all these things, but it goes on in the next thing, it's very interesting, the 23rd verse, that sexual lust cannot coexist with the spirit. It's full of denying the faith. You see, the Christian movement and others say that all love is the same. I mean, if you love, and that includes sex, promiscuity, everything else, any kind you can think of. But he that looks upon a woman who loves, after it shall deny the faith. If you give it the lust of this kind, it will distract. It will deny faith. Obviously, it's wrong. It's the other thing that doesn't. And shall not have the spirit. You can't have two spirits at work. You can't have the spirit. That would drive out all other considerations. That would be, whether you know it or not, happens to be a very strong physical form of reaction, and there is only to have trouble there. But you will deny the faith and not have the spirit. If you don't detect to be cast out. The clear statement in that 23rd verse that the definite limits and bounds have to be placed on sex. I mean, the idea that anything is all right, it's natural, it feels good, go ahead, and so forth and so on. No, you cannot have these two spirits at work. It's certainly plain. And of course, you find it. Charles used to stop his hippie friends. He used to know a lot of them down in St. Matt's Church, and he said, he's always gotten told, like, if you ask him, are you happy? Are you not? You can't have the idea that God will not make a wish with God. That's all the difference in the world. And we know we're wrong. Many of us are all through and through. The sense of conviction, the subconscious tone, and so forth. The idea you can argue yourself out of it, but you cannot have the spirit, he says, if you have lust to say that. That's what's going to be done there at all. And so, he goes on, the unrepentant adulterer shall be cast out, the unrepentant one, because the 24th verse. The repentant adulterer shall be forgiven. This is not the pure letter. This isn't the scarlet letter. This is the lie. But the repentant shall be forgiven. Unless he wants to make a regular practice of it. Now, we don't go into any morbid traffic here in credits and certificates of morality. The Jesuit, in the 16th and especially the 17th century, developed the doctrine of probability, which is great. This is the word that Pascal wrote the great provincial letters about. They can tell the Jesuit doctrine of probability when they fought the institution at the family of the Arnold at the famous monastery they set for there. But in reply to that, he made some of the probability. It's started by Molinas, the Spanish in the late 16th century, the 17th century became dominant, namely that any act, the morality of any act, is a probable value, and it depends entirely on the authority of the priest to consult how good or how bad it is. If you can find any authority in the church, any church father, any doctrine, any reference that will justify any act, then on the basis of probability, there's a probability that that might be all right. Then you can regard yourself as innocent. If you can find just one reference in millions that might justify that, probably there's a problem. So they call it probability. Of course, with his rigorous and disciplined buff, the immortal Pascal, we even had a field day with that. And it's probably the greatest volume of astrology. That's probably the greatest record. He's really about the problem. It's so utterly ridiculous. But this became a very popular doctrine, especially with the rulers, government people, and so forth, because they could do anything they wanted. All they had to do was run down the right church officials and they'd even look it up for them. Or if you felt, you wouldn't even have to consult any written authority. If you felt it could be justified by some line of argument, maybe things very simple, very sophisticated. Very sophisticated. They got marvelous effects for them. Then it was all right. So, of course, it was about to be destroyed all morality. This constant thinking of morality, this preoccupation, this morbid preoccupation with morality, destroys morality. It's the same thing you find in India, where this morbid denial of the flesh, the bed of nails and all this sort of thing, is the one thing that will keep you constantly in mind of the flesh. If they can never get it out of their mind, because they're always thinking of how they're denying it, running thorns and things like that.
Not morality alone,
but
what else is
going to
find
the last thing they offer. Oh, yes, that was part. Oh, heavens, yes. This is one of the most popular acts of the time, because this follows right after Machiavelli. See, Machiavelli justified things on the basis of Russia's project, the reasons of state, national security, justified any crime with Machiavelli. And this just took it up at a theological level, because of any kind of personal or private misbehavior could be justified. It's quite an immoral doctrine as far as that goes. But the 26th verse says, the adulterer shall not have a third chance. And again, thou shalt not speak evil of thy neighbor. Again, do you have to be a probabilist here and go into very careful analysis of what this means? No. When you talk about these things, it's perfectly plain. Everybody knows this. These are plain statements as far as I can. You could go into the fine print and justify everything. But that's an unhealthy sort of thing to do. You know what speaking evil of your neighbor is, but it must have been that. Or Epictetus says there's only one way to avoid it. There's only one way to avoid speaking evil of people, and never talk about people, either to praise them or to blame them or to despair them. That's the only way to avoid it. That thing is so forth. Nor do him any harm. So how can you avoid doing a person harm by oversight? Or be unaware. Oh, this is what happens to you. You will know. This is it. As far as you know, of course. Thou shalt not do your neighbor any harm. Well, by oversight, you see how you can justify this? Now you can do it in a long, rigmarole of moralistic discussions and arguments on and on and on about what if you do something and you're unaware of and so forth. That's not what it's talking about. You know what it's addressed to you. Thou shalt do these things. Thou shalt not do them any harm. Now you know what that can do. And who judges whether it's been harm or not? Well, you know it is. Whether you're doing harm or not. And then this one. Is God, very pretty nice one, is God authoritarian? Is he laying down the law here and saying, this is the way it is, and no other? No man can say to it. If thou lovest me, thou shalt serve me and keep all my commandments. He will do it out of love. If you love me, not you will do it, period, and not that. And like the military order, the tithes will be worn and that one is settled. And it's not even in the imperative. It's just the future indicative act. The tithes will be worn. Inconceivable that once the general is spoken, it will not happen. But that's not the way the Lord speaks at all. He always gives agency and he says, you will keep all my commandments to serve me if you love me. Yes. Christ commands the elements, but he commands the spirit. Except he never orders men to do this or that. And the apostle says, why don't you do anything? Leave it to Mr. Pertin, Mr. Udia, whatever it is. How often would I have taken thee unto my room? But he would not. He can't command you from Jerusalem to follow him. And just after saying this, thou shalt keep all my commandments, comes this. The commandment most likely be overlooked. He says, can you legislate virtue? Can you command people to be charitable? It's a very interesting thing. There are no laws whatever punishing or even suppressing the worst of all sins. There's no law requiring you to be generous or kind or forgiving or considerate or modest or prayerful. No law at all. Nor is there any law forbidding the opposite of any law. There's no law forbidding you to be mean and covetous. No law against taking the last pound of flesh. In fact, it's the law of the men to be if it's the last pound of flesh. Or the benefit instead of evil and victory instead of his. They're both taking advantage of the law, and it's rather unpleasant, something essentially wrong about both of them. It's wrong that a law should allow the person on a technicality to take the pound of flesh, and it's wrong that he should lose his body entirely on a technicality, and then draw about, well, it has been some blood, a drop of blood. That's what that 6 million drop of blood means, says, and that was another technicality. And, but it says, remember the poor. That is no law enforcing you to be one of God. How do you remember it? Tells you that. Consecrated thy properties for their support. Consecrate is to set aside, not to be touched to any other purpose. This one must be inviolable, he says, with a covenant and a deed which cannot be broken. People should be very serious. Now, as you know, businessmen and wives are very skilled at giving themselves and their clients the benefit of the doubt. You can get around anything you want. When the Lord lays down the law here, lays down the rules, that's up to you. No, but this is strictly a matter of your agency. You're not going to be required to do anything. If you love me, you will. And now we go on. Church officials, in the 31st verse, shall receive a specialized amount. The 32nd verse with a proper declaration as to the amount and purpose. After it has been deducted, every man to be accountable unto me for a steward over his own property. And for the proper consecrations and parts have been set aside. Or that which he has, or that which he received by consecration. You give by consecration, you receive by consecration. In either case, you know that all of them, rich and poor alike, are stewards. All of them, over their own. And as much as is sufficient for himself and his family. That's what it's called by what you receive by consecration. What you give by consecration is everything that's above that. What you receive by consecration is everything that's below that. So we kept on the even line. So the verses, any individual in the church who has property more than is necessary for their support, left over after its first consecration, being more than necessary, we call that a residue. And of course, there are other ways. I know the many people are not many people who don't pay a thing to tithing, so they need everything they've got. Of course, tithing is on your increase. So it's not increase, you tie it all back into the business, so they have no increase. And some of the richest men pay no tithing at all because they need that argument. That's what Brother Moyle told me, and he used to make things, and I had a long talk to him about things like that. Incidentally, I went to my first home off my mission, I went to see the Grand Richmond, who was presiding bishop there, the very first thing to plan and so forth. And in fact, he grew up, grown up with his church. And about paying tithing. Do I pay on the gross, I said, or do I pay on the net? If I pay on the gross, because everything is taken out already, I have nothing left at all. And he looked at me like surprised. There's no rules about those things. That's entirely up to you. That's what you need to know. You just have no reason to take this thing. So you pay on the gross, so you pay on the... So you pay on the gross, you understand. So you can go to the rest of the country. Well, that's not how you pay on the gross. Because that would have been the right thing to do. With business, with people in different businesses, and so forth, it's a different arrangement. You're not engaged in promoting things or... the normal business activities, you know, the different sort of things you have. So if another person uses a different rule, but it's up to him. Again, he's addressing you personally here. And here he says, every man who has need, that every man supply their routine according to his wants. Needs and wants, they are the makers. I say, you must need a lot more than I need or something. Well, nobody knows. No. Well, of course, that's clearly stated in 1 Timothy 6:5, where it tells us, having food and raiment, let us be very content. You want more than that, he says, you start getting the real stuff. Things that will attract you and so forth. But he who will be rich, follow him to temptation and snare and many seas and perpetual desires and life after things which lead many away from the faith. Well, and the residue is kept in the storehouse to administer to the poor and the needy by the proper authorities and to buy land for the public benefit of the church. This is laid down as a rule here in 1035. Most of the policy of the church to buy land for the ranches here and there, maybe there. That's been given to the very court. Common policy of buying land for the public benefit of the church, building churches and things like that. And unless you do it this way, he says in 36, you cannot become his covenant people and be gathered at the temple in due time. If you are cast out, your consecrated son, 37th verse, if you're cast out, the son you consecrated will not be refunded. This is different from the conversion. You've got two systems. You put aside everything you need, send you over to the society there, to give it all to the community. But when you, if you decide to leave, it's handed back to you. You can't have it back here because he says in the 38th verse, it's given to me. And it's given to me, I'm not going to give it back to you. I gave it to you in the first place. Now in the 39th verse, this is an Isaiah theme. I will consecrate the riches of those who embrace my gospel among the Gentiles and to the poor of my people who are of the house of Israel. As Gentiles, they acquire riches, God is saying. Whoever embraced the gospel has their property consecrated, or as Corvo would say, confiscated. That's Corvo, remember, he complained terribly about that. They cannot possess that to keep their own and so forth. And speaking of riches again, the 40th verse, not as status symbol. He cannot use them, he doesn't like that word. That all thy garments be plain, that means not the latest fashion. This is never plain. Or it couldn't sell. It has to be exotic, it has to be far out, it has to be weird, it has to be queer, it has to be bright, and all sorts of things to sell. Sometimes, for sheer novelty, they reverse the plain and simple and sensitive style, but it only lasts a short time. Because the fashion designers say you have to keep running up and down stairs. Keep acting. That means the church go up and then the church go down. And the church goes up, what else can you do? You see, going up and down. Another thing is called keep running up and down stairs to keep the business going. Well, we're going over this rather fast. We all know about this in the Bible. And on the other hand, it's something you should get into even discussions about forever after than people do. But what you do, you see, if you're going to discuss it with the Lord, don't discuss it with me. God is the same. Because you don't know my economy and I don't know yours. Let all thy garments be plain, and their beauty the beauty and the work of thine own hand. Of course, the girls all make their own clothes for most part. That's what better than what things cost today. But the beauty of thine own hands, that would be a design as much as anything. Does that mean every individual makes his own, as far as that goes? Well, Brigham Young had a great deal to say about that, because he had a lot of wives there, and they were very passionate cultures. And there was a lot of rivalry among them. And when one wife had the latest, the other had to have the latest. And he always conquered, because not only had the very latest people in household appliances and so forth, which he often designed himself, being a very skillful technician and artisan. But the other part of it, to keep peace in the family, he let them have these outrageous vows, but he used to give these parodies of the Grecian band of all the 30s and 70s after this Grecian band. But they had to go along with it, just to say, but he had a lot to say about the vile, vicious, foolish fashions of the world, and always told that that one wasn't going to get you anywhere, but you never were able to get rid of it. Then, cleanliness is essential in all things, you know that, 41st verse. Then, thou shalt not be idle, for he that is idle shall not eat the bread nor wear the garment of the lady. The interesting question arises, what is work? Busy work is a form of idle work, of course. The Puritan ethic requires us to be busy all the time, which incidentally is in direct consecration to the commandments of God. he is commanded to rest. He rested. But in the Puritan ethic, we feel guilty unless we do. What can you do about that? You should be working, and you're haunted by feelings of guilt if you're not working. And the best thing, since that's impossible, what do? You pretend. We become terrible hypocrites with our work ethic. We don't work very hard at all. And, for example, what about the work that I do? Forging, I type, and I shuffle papers, and I seal envelopes, and I return books to the library, and I make xeroxes. Now, this is work, and it has to be done, and it's tedious, and it's boring, and people should be paid for it. And I have a girl who does that. A girl, we had about five in the last year. They get pregnant, and that's the last to see it. You can't keep a good sex there to be right here. I've lost five of them this time. The last one I had was a dream. She was a marvelous idea. She had to go. And to have a baby, that was that. And so another one in a place that was cheaper. Just as she'd get trained and so forth. Well, the girls that can do that, it's work. And I said, it should be done. It has to be done. And there's another type of work. I sit in committee, and I doodle, and I browse, and I attend meetings. Is that work? Well, it's painful enough to produce rashes and boils and heart attacks and ulcers and things like that. That's a very unpleasant type of work, but it is labor. It is toil, what the Greeks would call to labor, to toil, to put some word in the same word for all of them. One of the qualifications for being a dean, in fact, the only qualification around here, is unhesitating willingness to attend and sit through any and all meetings. That's a painful assignment. It's a painful assignment. Some people do it, and they deserve to be rewarded for it. But then again, I try to latch onto enough paradigms and vocabulary and syntax to read certain ancient neglected writings, read old documents. Well, that begins to look more like work then. I'll get up and I'll read. Here's a document in a terrible hand and so forth. I have to read it, because we have to put these two together. And now it's even look more like work. It's a real effort. Well, then I come to this to work, to reading the text carefully, and putting them together with any other relevant statements I can find, digging this stuff up. This is the hardest work yet. Never just mechanically, even with a computer. You can't keep track of all these things. You have to relate these things yourself. And then I take a walk, and think about them and what they may signify, especially with relationship to the gospel. And this is the hardest work of all, just walking around outdoors, in danger of being picked up by the campus priest for vagrancy. For at the BYU, we do not tolerate idleness. For the first time, though, I'm really working, and I'm in danger of being picked up for vagrancy. This is the hardest of all. As a matter of fact, I'm terrified at the work that confronts me, someone's work I have to do tomorrow morning. It's really terrifying. I have some extremely angry and disillusioned and mocking and challenging letters about Joseph Smith and about other things and about my destroying Egyptian and so forth and so on. And there's something that really has to be taken care of. I mean, it has to be very important. It's what you might call a challenge. It takes an awful lot of work. I could be losing a lot of things, but if he was right, it can be done and has been. But all these things are working together for me. And which is it when he says you shall not be idle? Our pure work ethic is pure apostasy. Let's go on. 43rd verse. The sick who do not have faith to be healed, they're the ones administered by the elders. This 42nd chapter is full of surprise. It's long, everywhere, along with the book of us, and move on with it. So, the sick who do not have faith to be healed shall be treated not with extreme cure-alls or remedies, such as were very common among the sick. They had quite too much of easy to get, but gently and sympathetically, he put the giving nature a maximum chance to do its work. He was mild things, mild things, not wild or extreme. And it's worded very nicely here in the 43rd verse. Whoever's among you and are sick and have not faith to be healed, but believe, shall be nourished with all tenderness. They believe, but they don't have enough faith to be healed. That's one of the gifts for faith, faith to be healed. Shall be nourished with all tenderness, deferred, mild, smooth, and that not by the hand of an enemy. That psychological part of it is so very important. I often feel that the doctor may even be your enemy. When you get to him, wonder if he's your friend, you know. And the elders of the church, and then he goes on here. The elders shall administer to them to make their passing acceptable. And there's no mention in this verse of the healing. The healing comes later. There's no mention of healing there. They may live and they may die, but it will be well with them. They're administered by the elders, as far as that goes. And then, thou shalt live together in love. Well, do we? We shall weep. And then he says, insomuch that thou shalt weep for the loss of them that die, and more especially for those that do not have hope of a glorious resurrection. Well, should we weep most for the ones we disbelieve? The bad people are the ones we're supposed to be weeping for, of course. It's not our loss we weep for, but theirs. It's not inconsistent. We weep at a wrathful parting, but we smile at a friendly parting. Whether it's the station or somewhere else, the airport or somewhere else. It's sad when people part in rage and when people part in ill feeling, but when they part in good feeling, it's a happy time. But we, it's sorrow that we're separated, but most especially for those who do not have hope of the glorious resurrection, that's where they feel sorry. And it shall come to pass, we haven't got there yet, you know, that those who die in thee, what does that mean? Here's a very important thing, shall not think to this. This may very well account for the many statements you have. I know the patriarchal blessings where people have been promised that they would not face the death before the second coming. At which time, later on in this section, it goes to be changed in quickly and not face the death at that time either. The case of the death is not the same thing as it's happening. He's going to say, that's not death at all. For it shall be sweet unto them. The resurrection is always a thing. But your fault is it's not. You have not been living right in the right state of mind. He says, you don't taste of it. You don't die, it will be sweet to you. And they that die not in you, woe unto them, for their death is bitter. Now, this death is the ultimate disaster. Last week it was measure for measure. It was just a horrifying plan, but a marvelous plan. And their body, it really can do anything rather than just the death of Holy Spirit. And yet, I, but to die, go into love. Where? To live in cold on, to lie in cold on obstruction and to rot. It's sensible. Warm motion to become a needed spawn. The weariest and most loathed earthly life, worldly life, the weariest and most loathed, loathed worldly life, that and imprisonment can lay upon nature is a paradise compared with what we here have. The weariest and most lonely and worldly life of all, but the ache, pain, penury, and imprisonment can lay upon nature is a paradise compared with what we here have. See, that's how bitter it is. Anything is better than that. So that is the way you think of it at all. Those that are told that they shall not die or shall not taste the death until the second coming. What they're talking about this, what that experience really is, because it's a joyful experience, they shall not taste of it. It shall be sweet unto them. But under any other conditions, bitter. So apparently, the fault is ours if we're still as terrified as we are. Now, it's plain that all these we've been being almost kept a long, long. It's plain that not all these teachings are going to be popular with the Latter-day Saints. From verses 59 and 60 here. Still, they must be observed or be damned, for they have accepted the gospel. It's a package deal, he's telling us in 59 and 60 here. Thou shalt take these things which thou hast received, which have been given unto thee in my scriptures for a law, to be a law to govern my church. And he that doth according to these things shall be saved, and he that doeth them not shall be damned, if he so continue. You have to take the whole package, he's telling us here. Now, whatever you need, ask for it. Again, notice the 61st verse. This is the wonderful thing that comes up. Whatever you need, ask for it, and you shall receive. Well, what should you ask for? Revelation upon revelation, knowledge upon knowledge. Now, we pity those who say a Bible, we have got us a Bible, we need no more Bible. If you say revelation, revelation, you have revelation, you need no more revelation. A prophet, you have a prophet, and that's all we need. Are we concerned about getting more knowledge? Notice the emphasis on the more, knowledge upon knowledge. Adam
Abraham ever seeking greater light and knowledge?
The knowledge of what?
This verse goes on, though. Of the mystery and peaceable things. How about the practical things, the marketable knowledge? Why mystery? The knowledge we seek is that which bringeth joy, that which bringeth life eternal. Now, for example, 62nd verse, next verse. Thou shalt ask, and it shall be revealed unto thee in mine own due time. We don't control these things. Where the new Jerusalem shall be built. From there my servant shall be sent forth, he says in the 63rd verse, in the four directions. Next verse, to urge all who believe to flee to the west. Why? Because of growing dangers where they are. That which is coming upon the earth, which will culminate in the terrible civil war, and so on. And because of secret combinations. They can't fight them. You can't fight them, get out and come. The movement to perfect. If you act accordingly, now it's not going to be easy, but Johnson the 65th verse, if you act accordingly, you will not regret it. Great shall be thy reward. You will have all the advantage, for unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom, but unto the world it is not given to know. Well, now, what are these mysteries of the kingdom? It is knowledge shared by initiates in the first place. They are mysteries. They're shared by you. As it tells us in this verse, to the outsiders, it's not given. That makes it a mystery for one thing. You don't talk about it. It's known only to you. The funny thing is, even if you try to tell them about it, it still remains a mystery because it won't register. They won't take it. They won't understand it. How many people, friends of mine, not only refuse to believe what I tell them, but they won't believe for a minute that I believe it. They can't be able to see that anyone could possibly believe it. So that you can't reach them with this. It will remain a mystery as far as they're concerned. No danger of giving too much away. And the world is blind to everything about the kingdom. It's in their midst, and they know it not, like that X-ray universe. We showed you with this new X-ray, they've been getting some new reports this week on it too. You see here, here's another universe. These are stars we've never seen. No one ever knew they were there until this super instrument, 300 times more powerful than any other one up. We suddenly discovered here with these other universes. There are different colors, there are different stars entirely. They're flashing on and off, most of them, like neon lights, no matter the second per minute. And this happens to be a quasar showing up here. We can't see them at all. I mean, they've been there all the time, and we don't know about it. Right in the midst of it. They say, just as real, just as near, just as tangible, the same type of material, everything else. So they just don't happen to lie and say, no, it's not there. You know, our section is a spectrum. And that's the sort of thing it's talking about here, when it tells the world is blind to everything about the kingdom. The kingdom is in the midst of the world, it doesn't know it. So there are the mysteries of the kingdom. Those who do know the kingdom, it says in the 66th verse, the next verse, live by its laws. So it's as if we were to discover those other stars, that other universe out there, we started telling time using our clocks and so forth by its cycles, rather than the cycles that you can normally see here. And this qualifies them. If they live by its laws, it says then, the 67th verse, you will be qualified for knowledge upon knowledge. Covenants to come. In Kirtland, they haven't yet received the covenant. The temple, the Kirtland temple was still to come, which is the greatest of all revelations. Never all knowledge, but sufficient. Notice this is another thing. We know we do not have all the covenants and ordinances of the temple, those we observe today. Some have been withdrawn, as a matter of fact. But we do have, and this is a very important point made in the 67th verse, we do have sufficient to establish us where we stand now for the next step. We have firm ground to stand on to take the next step here. Sufficient to establish you both here and in the New Jerusalem. Certainly wasn't yet the New Jerusalem. And both here and in the New Jerusalem, what we are given at any one time is sufficient to establish, to give you a firm foothold for taking the next step. And so such revelations are not limited to the leader. From the 68th verse, he that lacketh wisdom, let him ask of me, and I will give him liberally. If you lack wisdom, of course, in James it says, whosoever, wisdom. Lacketh wisdom, let him ask, all that he is asking, it will be given to him. So this is open to everybody. What is the kingdom? 69th verse. Unto you the kingdom, or in other words, God knows what the kingdom is, the kingdoms of the church have been given to you for the building up of the whole world.